You're listening to Face Off, episode 36, recorded September 26, 2009. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com. All right, so a little heads up, I guess, before we start the episode. Mark and I are talking about the show, and we decided that it might be kind of a fun experiment for 2 weeks, and starting off 2 weeks, of course, to cut the show down to a half an hour.
Yep. So, make it a little bit easier to digest for, you know, the people that are busy. And
yeah, I mean, it kind of started as I was thinking that I think an hour-long podcast, for me personally, is just a little too long. There's things like, you know, PodShifter we talked about on the iPod that can speed them up. But we were also hoping just maybe it'll help us get, you know, to, you know, condense our idea. We can maybe better themed shows that don't scatter about as much. But mainly it was for you guys. We thought maybe we'd try and see if a half-hour podcast was, like Mark said, easier to digest and easier to make sure everybody can listen to the whole thing.
And if you end up hating it after the 2 weeks, let us know, and we'll definitely go back to the old way. But if you end up liking it, also let us know.
Yeah, either way. To faceoffshow.com/feedback. Let us know what you think. We're going to do it for 2 weeks, so you got, you know, a couple weeks to try it and let us know what you think. So we're curious, wondering what you guys think about it. So let's get into our news and follow-ups. Our first news and follow-ups, and this is a big one that happened a little while ago, but we've talked so much about the app that we have to talk about it.
Yep.
Intuit acquires Mint for $170 million.
Wow. And, I mean, Mint hasn't been around for very long. No. I mean, you know, a year, 6 months?
Yeah.
When it got popular anyway.
And it's a juggernaut. So
Intuit, they make QuickBooks.
Yeah.
For people that don't know who Intuit is. But, yeah, this is big news for both the web app community and Mint. I mean, Mint's a cool app.
Yeah. And it's caused quite a controversy. I mean, people are really nervous. A lot of us see it as, the little guy that's selling out to the man.
Yeah.
Intuit is definitely, quote, the man of the sort of financial application market.
Well,
you know, personal finance.
If you were offered $170 million, would you sell out to the man?
It's a tough thing. I mean, obviously, I want to be like, of course I wouldn't. I would, you know, but they've had to do a lot of damage control with this. I've seen both Mint and Intuit doing a lot of damage control, saying they're not going to change Mint. They're not going to make you pay for it. The same people are going to be in charge. You know, the Mint guys are going to take over basically the Intuit web app sort of, division or whatever. Mm-hmm. People are nervous about it, and likely so. I know a couple of people that just flat out, the day it happened, quit Mint.
Really?
They said, I'm done with Mint. Yep, I don't like Intuit. Intuit is... They think, you know, an evil company, so they say, I'm out. What else can I use?
Really?
So, it's, yeah. I don't know. I mean...
You've been using it a lot more than I have.
I love Mint. Both me and my wife use Mint exclusively to keep track of our finances.
Now, I use it, but not as much as you. And so, I mean, it was a great app, though.
Yeah, totally.
It's still the same, right?
Yeah, they haven't changed anything yet. They haven't changed anything yet, but it's concerning. It really is. One of the reasons I really liked Mint was it was this sort of startup out of the middle of nowhere that I had never heard of that I thought was kind of cool. This cool little company that I thought was eventually going to end up being, you know, like the next Intuit. Because I thought these guys are doing stuff so well. They really like what they're doing that I thought they would, you know, stick and keep going as themselves. So it was kind of saddening for me.
Do you think it's kind of like a privacy issue? Like they might start selling your information a little bit more, or it's just the company itself?
No, it's just once, you know, like their objectives. I think their goals are not the same as Intuit's. I think Intuit, you know, will say that their goal is to, personal finance apps accessible to the average man. I just think they have clashing goals. I thought Mint did a really good job. I thought it had a great business model. I thought it had a great sort of strategy to monetization. Intuit's monetization strategy is clearly just pay for the software. They like subscription-based services. Mint has never really done that. They said, we're going to offer good opportunities for people to save money, so these offers will bring us money and help our customers save money. I thought that was a great business idea, sort of two birds with one stone. So, you know, I don't know. But then again, like I said, they've done a lot of damage control saying Intuit's acquired Mint, but they don't want to change it. So I don't know.
Well, we talked about Mint in episode 3, so if you don't know what Mint is, or if you want to check it out, definitely go check that episode out. Yeah. And
I didn't quit. I didn't quit Mint. I didn't disable my accounts like some of the people I did. I'm going to see how it turns out.
Okay. Give them a
fair chance. Check it out. But again, I guess a good idea can get you $170 million. Yeah. So
that was the point we wanted to bring up.
Keep working.
So the next thing we got here is, the last episode we talked about Gzip, and it was a great way to speed up your website. But we were wondering if it was backwards compatible, and most importantly, would it work still on,
mobile devices?
Yeah, mobile devices. Something with low CPU power, yeah. Basically. And it turns out, yes, it's backwards compatible. If the server doesn't have the Gzip, it just sends a regular one. The client has to specifically request a Gzip page. So
okay, so it by default it just is always sending straight. You know, I'm assuming ASCII.
And it's also Gzip was built into the HTTP 1.1 spec. So most browsers, it's like Netscape from '95 or something, most browsers should have it. And as far as mobile devices, I'm not sure if all support it, but I do know I tested on the iPod. There's a website. At whatsmyip.org/http_compression. And the iPod Touch and probably the iPhone, since it's the same thing, does do Gzip compression. There's a little detection script on the site that shows you that.
Interesting. I'm trying to get to it on my... So I have a Motorola Q phone, which is an older phone. Mm-hmm. And I was going to go to it and see if it did, because I forgot to before the show started. But I can't find the underscore. That's frustrating.
So,
because it's like an old, this old Pocket Internet Explorer is a dirty gertie when it comes to doing stuff. It doesn't work a whole lot. So I was very curious.
So there's still the downsides of Gzip, I guess, is it's processor intensive for the server, but it saves on bandwidth. I think most, in general, it's a good idea to turn it on, but I'm sure there's probably cases where you might want to consider
not. I don't know if definitely if it's built into the HTTP 1.1 spec that it sends out regular ASCII text, unless they specifically request Gzip, then why not?
Yep.
Save yourself some bandwidth. Save your users some bandwidth. So I wonder if pages render differently. I wonder because some pages you get them. Because wouldn't a Gzip page, it has to get the entire file and then unencrypt it or uncompress it. I wonder if a regular website has the ability to stream more as it's loading.
If you're talking about the PHP obflush thing where you can just send half the page and then have that render, you could probably send those packets that make up that part of the page in Gzip and then.
Okay. Wonder.
I think it. Yeah. Now we'll have to do another. Yeah, exactly. See if Gzip compresses each packet or if it does the whole thing and then sends out the packets.
Follow up crazy.
So that's a follow up on the Gzip. And so the next thing we got is Google lets you actually tell them what URL parameters to ignore.
Yeah, you and I talked about this personally. I don't think we ever talked about it on the show, but a long time ago you were doing a project where in PHP where you enabled sessions. And apparently with PHP when you enable sessions, it starts putting that sort of stuff into the URL, right? Is like a query string, like a hidden query string or something like that.
Yeah, typically the way you want to handle sessions is have a cookie with a token in it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes on shared hosts they'll make the URL the default where it puts it in the URL, and that's almost never what you want. And what happened on one of the sites that I was working on, I didn't know about that, and all of a sudden Google started indexing all these pages with these URL strings. I was like, that's kind of weird. And then all of a sudden they just, all the pages dropped off Google. They were first page for a lot of keywords. And all of a sudden they were gone for everything. And it was, and then we got rid of that and it took a while, but they came back. So definitely you don't want to, basically it came down to I had duplicate content.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just getting penalized for that. And so if you had this, you could say, Google, ignore these pages because they're just duplicates.
Ignore these variables in the query string. So if I put, SID, which a lot of them, the session ID equals, if I put that in the URL string, ignore that. Just don't even count that as part of the URL and what you're doing. So you wouldn't get penalized.
You can also do the canonical thing that we talked about before.
The canonical, yeah.
I forget the canonical
URL link. Tag.
Yeah, yeah, that one.
But this is cool. It's showing that that Google is really listening to its constituents, and the truth is it's becoming almost it's the de facto search engine.
Well, anything that helps Google do their job better, I mean, helps everybody.
Yeah,
you get searches more relevant.
Again, this is another one of those two birds with one stone. Google is able to index pages better because you can go in and tell it what to ignore, so it's getting a better index. It's getting more, you know, the content that is more relevant is being displayed up top. It's, you know, helping, it's being more forgiving to bad programming.
Yeah, I mean, definitely,
not, you know.
Yeah. Well, like, some parameters are meant for users only. They're never meant really for indexing. Like, if you were going to sort the page differently, you have another parameter. Like, that doesn't make, this doesn't matter for a search engine.
Exactly.
But a search engine in the past might look at that other URL and say, this is duplicate content, just sorted a little bit different.
Yeah.
And totally. So this way, you could
tell it, no, that doesn't count.
It doesn't count.
So thank you, Google. We appreciate that. I haven't really used it yet, but
yeah. And also another thing is the robots.txt, which is a file that you can specify search engine robot. Well, all robot rules crawlers that come to your site. You can say don't go into this directory here.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, I've played around that a little bit. You have like a really good you've given me before a robots.txt
for WordPress
because you went through and but I wonder if the Ultimate SEO plugin probably takes care of that now. Which is a good plugin. We use it too. The next news item, I told you we had a lot, is that Digsby sees the light and removes some of the bundled crapware. We talked about this a while ago. Digsby, which was a really popular instant messaging program, got kind of caught red-handed with putting, you know, some software that wasn't really clear that they were putting on your system when you installed Digsby, mm-hmm. doing things like distributed computing stuff in the background that you didn't know about. Well, now they've sort of made it better in that they instead of they ask you, so it's like or no.
Well, the reason we're talking about this Digsby is because we talked about the Digsby news in the past. This happened a little while ago, but you know. I don't know. It's they're seeing the light, I guess. I mean, they're coming out.
Okay, so it asks you for now. It asks you. It says, "Hey, do you want to install this distributed computing software?" You know, which is kind of one of the big ones that people are really upset about. Mm-hmm. And they said, "You know, do you want to install this?" You can hit yes or no. Okay, they're not really telling you what they're doing with this yet, but they're at least asking you. That's cool. I think most people will say no. And then they also ask you if you want to install the ask.com toolbar, which I hate these. I hate these search bars and they're just terrible.
Yeah. They all do it though. There's articles saying, you know, the Java client does, Skype, Foxit, DivX, yeah. uTorrent, even the newer versions of Winamp.
Yeah. It's just ridiculous. I don't like them.
I don't like it at all anyways. But, I mean, if this is the only way they can make decent software, I mean, I like Skype. I wouldn't want Skype to go away. So if this is the only way is to have a portion of their users to use some kind of a bar and get some money out of it, I guess.
I guess, yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
They should. But what I like about it is they kind of, you know, saw their mistake and responded at least a little bit to their users'
concerns. Yeah, totally. Yeah, instead of just kind of saying, whatever. You know,
I mean, if you ignored it, they would have been gone fast.
Oh, totally.
They already kind of were from this article.
Yeah, I think their user base got hit really hard from that. So, good work, Digsby. You're getting there.
So that's the news and follow-ups that we had, and so we'll get into the web apps.
All right, so the first web app we have was actually submitted by one of our listeners, which I Quasim, Q-A-S-I-M, I'm not sure. I try
Quasim,
to...
Quasim, maybe?
Quasim, yeah. I don't know. I try and fancify everything that I say, so Quasim. The first one is called ReCSS. It's a really simple little web app. If you've done any development with CSS... in the past, you've either noticed that sometimes you make a change and you hit refresh and it doesn't show up, or if you really dig into it, you know, like in Firefox, you have to hit Control Shift R to do mm-hmm. a hard reset, yep. Which is if once you learn to do that, I don't ever hit F5 anymore. Any time I refresh is Control Shift R just because I've mm-hmm. had to train myself to do right. that, which can be a pain in the butt. And if you don't want to use keyboard shortcuts, ReCSS is a bookmarklet that you can put in that you can click it and it will reload the CSS from the server for you.
Make sure it gets the newest version of that file that it's requesting.
Yeah. So if you're one of those people like you just you don't really want to learn your keyboard shortcuts, but you're doing development with CSS and you've noticed this happens, because I'm sure you have if you develop with CSS.
Well, sometimes you also can have caching turned on in your CSS. You might have something in your HD access file that says, turn on caching for this file forever, and you might not, even the control shift R, I don't think would.
I think it does. I think that's the whole point of it.
Okay.
But the caching, again, like you were saying, it's never, I've found it's never consistent. Mm. So I've just, it's always getting to the habit, because I've done this before where I'll make a change in the CSS file, I go to the page, and I just hit F5 to refresh.
And you don't see the change.
Oh, what did I do wrong? So I go back and I change, and then 30 minutes later, I am nowhere near where I was to begin with. And then I go, I close the browser. You used to do it. You close the browser out, make sure you've closed all windows, reopen it up, and then it's the way it was.
Do you ever do the thing where it's like, man, I know something's going on here. I gotta do something really goofy just to make sure the CSS is working. Like, just like blast it all out, delete it all.
Yeah, exactly. Like background red.
Or like put the background red just to see that it's working.
Yeah. Oh, of course.
Because you might have some other silly mistake or something.
You're like, I'm going to make the body of the entire web page bright red with green text. And you hit refresh and you're like, okay, there's definitely some caching error or something going on. Yep. So check it out, ReCSS. The link is in the show notes. It's not like a really easy to remember one. So check it out. The next web app we want to talk about, this one was also submitted by Quazim. It's called the Gridinator.
Gridinator.
What the Gridinator does is it helps you sort of develop using a grid system.
Mm-hmm. And we talked about this before. Grid systems are kind of cool. It helps. I don't know. I've started using 960 grid system.
Yep.
And I like it. It just makes development way easier, just having certain sections for stuff.
Yeah, definitely. So with Gridinator, you get kind of a default grid of a particular width. You can set the number of columns you want in your grid, the column width, the column margin, container margin, all that fun junk. And then you can set, do you want to do it with pixel widths? Do you want to do it with EM widths, with percentage widths? How do you want to do it? And then what it will do is you can export either like a grid image as a PNG, or you can get the HTML and CSS template for however you set up your grid system.
So simple, awesome, easy to use. Grid system.
Yeah, exactly. And it's at the Gridinator. So, you've used a lot of these. I really haven't yet, or not a lot, but you've used these sort of grid things more. Is it typical? Do you do about 960 or so?
Well, and that's the thing.
16 columns or what?
In the last few projects, I've used the 960 grid system, which is the URL is 960.js. It comes with its own CSS kind of framework, if you want to call it. And so I'm using that, but if you didn't want the framework, but you still wanted the grid system, this would be perfect.
Okay. So why do I want a grid system though? I mean, what's better about it?
You don't have to worry about how do I get this centered and then a div inside of this div. Mm-hmm. It makes everything really simple. It also kind of locks things down in some ways, and certain borders and certain things get locked down a little bit. I wouldn't recommend it to somebody who's super new to CSS, because they might not understand a little bit of what's going on in the background.
Yeah, totally.
But if you've used CSS for a while and you just kind of want a rapid prototype, a site up, I think it's great. There's some people that might argue that it's, it's adding bloat to your CSS and doing some things, but I'm all for rapid, get it done, rapid, get it up, and then maybe tweak it after the fact. Yeah. Maybe go in and
totally
make something. So,
that was the Gridinator. Again, if you guys have any news and feedbacks or web apps you want us to talk about, make sure you let us know. Go to faceoffshow.com/feedback and give us a shout out. We our two web apps, again, were submitted by our readers. Thank you. We appreciate it. That's always cool. What's cool about these is I had not heard about them at all. I mean, sometimes you get submissions and you're like, I saw that. I decided not to talk about it, but I hadn't heard of either of these. So
there's this cool app called Groove Shark.
So I don't know if you've messed with these Google Docs, right? They're really cool.
And Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah. So anyways, submit some web apps. Thank you. We always appreciate it. Okay, Mark. So before we go on, though, I forgot to do something at the beginning of the episode. I forgot to ask you a question. I like to ask Mark questions because he's a smart guy. So, Mark, why did the programmer quit his job?
Why? I don't know.
Because he didn't get a raise. raise. Get it a raise or
a raise.
Oh, I had to explain it to you. That's a bad sign.
I thought you meant like raise an exception or something.
Oh no, that's a good one too. Okay, God, these are just getting better by the week. Let's get into our topics. That was bad. Our next topic is 10 usability or useful usability findings and guidelines. This is a Smashing Magazine article with some really thought provoking stuff. We thought in it.
We have we've talked about some studies that I believe it was Sun that put out on usability and people liked scannable content and things and. Smashing Magazine did at the bottom of this article, they've got some statistics that they did themselves, and there's some really interesting stuff here. So we're going to start in with the first one is form labels work best above the field. So if you've got an email address text box, you put the email address label just above it instead of on the side or the bottom or something.
Yeah, next to it, which is always a big thing because you had to use like tables or something to get it next to it. But they're finding that you really want to put the text above it. I'm not sure what I think about this on really long forms. Like a short form, email address, password, that makes sense. Maybe even email address, password, first name, last name, age, okay. But what about like if you're doing a web app whose job is to collect large amounts of data? I don't know. What do you think of that? Like for a really long
time? It's always hard to figure out what, because like maybe you'll have like some pictures and then a description of that picture below it, or do you put the description of the picture above it and then have the picture? And so you'll be scrolling.
Description below, always. Caption below. Because it's a caption.
Okay, but sometimes they do it different. You'll be on one website and they'll have the description above or something.
Yeah.
So I think, they did a study by UX Matters, and they found that the label works best if it's above. So, makes sense. It's saying this is the email address, and then there's the form for it.
Yeah, that's true. And it's easier to program. Actually, it's a lot easier to put the label to a form item above it. Then you don't have to put a table in or mix with
absolute float.
Yeah, still, that's I think floats are a much bigger pain in the butt than this and then right below. The next one is that users focus on faces. And this one blew my mind. I mean, I knew this, but really, they have some heat maps on here of a picture with a baby. And in the first picture, the baby is looking at the user. And immediately on the heat map, people's eyes went right to the baby's face and then maybe to the title. Mm-hmm. Just, it's like the title is, and the text is sort of a light green, but the baby's face has this big red heat spot in the middle of it. People look at faces, and people have known this for a while, because if you go to all these websites, it's been a trend lately. There's faces everywhere. There's people working. Mm-hmm. Usually they're all multicultural, very multi-ethnic people looking at you, and it's just really cheesy, and it's become a trend. But this article has a great idea, or it points out something great. If the face of the baby is looking at the text immediately, many, many, many more people look at the text next.
It's like, the baby's looking at it. I got to look at it too. Yeah, it's like, one of those sneaky marketing tricks that are like,
what's that baby looking at? Yeah. Oh, he's looking at that text. And really, the text just gets a much bigger heat area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look at the difference between the first one. It's like it's all focused on the face and a little bit on the text, and then it's all on the text.
Yeah, so I mean, for the longest time, it's been put a face in your website because it grabs people's attention. They won't hit the back button, but they'll also just look at the face and leave. This blew my mind. I mean, if you just have the face looking at the text, people look at it too. So keep that in mind. I mean, a face is not a cure-all.
Well, sometimes, people will put some pictures in there because they look nice, but if it starts distracting and taking away from the content and your actual what you're trying to get across from the website, you're.
Absolutely. The next one is that quality of design is an indicator of credibility, and this is true. If you put a little bit of time into a good design, people really feel like either think that you paid for it, therefore, you are an actual business that is trying hard.
Definitely.
They'll put money into it, or at least then if it is good, you put good time into it, and you must know what you're talking about.
Also, from a programmer standpoint, if you look through their code and it looks the HTML source code or just the way it's laid out or whether or not they're using CSS rollovers or JavaScript or whatever, it's like, man, these guys are paying attention to detail.
Yep.
And so absolutely, they must be paying attention to detail in the product or service that they're selling. So
definitely. When it comes to your design, users judge the book by its cover. So and sort of in a very similar thing, users, the next one is that users do not scroll. On average, users look at and they see what they see when they first get on, and if they don't like it, they leave. They don't hunt down and look. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, it's saying only 23% will scroll on their first visit to a website.
Yeah. And that makes sense. So, you know, make sure, look at, you know, think about what resolutions you're at, because obviously if you're designing for a really huge resolution, if people can't see it, if they have to scroll, you need to know that. And also have the really important, the good, relevant information up top.
Yeah, they call that above the fold, above the old newspaper terminology. And that's where your most important content should live.
Absolutely. The next one is that blue is the best color for links. This is just ingrained in our head. You know, links have been that sort of bright blue we've seen forever. I think a good design can accommodate it enough that a link stands out. Like, for example, even though my design at Montana Fright Fest is ugly, that theme is old, I need to revamp it. The entire theme is sort of this black gray, and links are this bright orange, this sort of alternate color, and I think they really stand out. But again, if I really, really wanted to, I would try and incorporate a design with a blue link, because people, it's just so ingrained in our head.
Yeah, and it was the default color back in the day.
Absolutely, yeah. So. Yep, still is. On most browsers, if you don't do any CSS, links are
one thing
that
I'd also say
with
is
the purple visited. I hate the purple visited. I'm never going to keep the purple visited.
Working at the university, I know we had an issue once where they had to underline the links. And that was a big deal for usability.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Because sometimes, otherwise, you don't know it's a link.
Yeah. Oh, not at all.
It might be a different color, but you could be colorblind or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can't. That's a terrible idea.
Maybe underline or a dotted line underneath, something to indicate that it's a link.
The next one is that the ideal search box is 27 characters wide.
Well, you know, Google changed the width of their search box lately. And so...
Yeah. That's crazy. So, I mean, like, they say that extending the box to 27 characters accommodates 90% of Google's queries. And the average search box is 80 characters wide.
Now, I get kind of annoyed if I have like a really small, maybe like a 12 or 15 character long search box, and I'm starting to type something. It's somewhat annoying. So,
well, a really good example is that the Apple search is small, and if you're searching for Microsoft Office 2008, it gets cut off, and it's just annoying. It's very frustrating. It doesn't fit. So, the next one is that white space improves comprehension.
Definitely.
Oh, you know, we talked about this. Yeah. You did some really good research into typography, into just like in expanding things, and it makes it so much more easy to read.
Yeah. You know, the first time I noticed, I was on ProBlogger's website, and I was like, man, this is easy to digest his posts. And I don't think it's just the writing style. There's something here. And I found out it was the line spacing.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, really look at your white space. Look at what some of these guys are doing. I think we tried. We want to make it look like a newspaper. Newspapers have spent so much time on this; they know. And newspapers are easy to read. So,
And they're talking about the white space not only just between the lines, but paragraphs and stuff. And this study in 2004, they found that it increases comprehension by almost 20%.
Yeah, that's amazing. A big deal. That's a lot of comprehension. I mean, by changing your typography, definitely.
And I definitely noticed it myself. So. Definitely. Now, this one was really cool. This next one is effective user testing doesn't need to be extensive. So I was always, you know, under the impression that I had to have, you know, 200 people check out my site and give me feedback before I really
would get everything. Yeah.
You know, that I had a good design or something. They're actually finding this Jacob Nielsen study found that you only need about 15 users, and that's enough to find pretty much all the usability problems.
Yeah, I mean, I would say pretty much anything after 6 users tends to be maybe the amount of time it takes them is not worth it.
Yep.
But the big thing here is any number of testing is better than none, right? If you have 3 people test your website, this is about 70% of your problems. That's pretty good.
So don't get discouraged and say, "Hey, I have too small of a website. I can't possibly go and user test and stuff." Yeah, you can. You only need 6 users. I'm sure you can find 6.
And make sure you have 6 people that have, you know, never seen it before, are definitely not programmers on the project, because they'll go through it and go, "Yeah, everything works great the way it's supposed to."
Yeah, exactly.
The next one is informative product pages help you stand out. Their example here, and I'll admit it, is Apple. Apple has amazing product pages. I can't go to apple.com because I'm afraid I'll buy something, and I'm not a huge Apple guy, you know.
Yeah,
but like they do all these sort of little boxes with, like, you know, information about the video cap, like, so for example, the iPod Nano with video capture, there's a little box that talks about video capture with a very distinct sort of almost little photograph of the camera on the back. It catches your eyes immediately in the middle. They're very informative. And it's not
the little
extremely
chunks.
Yeah, exactly. It's not extremely spreadsheety, you know, spec sheet like. It's not. You can get that if you want, but this is more about what you're going to use it for and how and why you'd want to use it.
It's easy. I mean, they're little chunks, so it's easy to digest. It's not a big giant tech spec page, or, like you said.
Absolutely. The next one is that most users are blind advertising, and this is so true.
And it doesn't matter if it's not technically an ad. If it looks like an ad, they're probably ignoring it.
Yeah.
Or if it's in a spot that an ad normally is. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing is, you have to think about what is it worth? Some people, if they're going to ignore it anyways, I don't know. I think advertising is going to change in the future, that they're going to realize that people are ignoring these or otherwise blocking them using Firefox extensions. And it's going to, you know, you definitely won't get money for just, you know, impressions or clicks. They're going to really try and find ways to convert on it, which I don't think is right. I think it's better to... I don't know. I don't know what the right revenue model is. People don't like the model of having a company pay you to write a review on something, because mm-hmm. then it's like, well, are you writing the review so that you can get more items in the future? Are you being true to your craft? I don't know. What are your thoughts?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. If you're going to do ads, I would say do it up front. Even if you're, don't have a big user base. Yeah. I wouldn't try to surprise them. And definitely, like, if Twitter, you know, is free now, and then they all of a sudden start charging everybody $1 a month to stay on Twitter, yeah, I think people would leave.
And make sure they're relevant. Make sure they're useful. Like we talk about this, Google AdSense is great, but at the same time, it's not. It's really a crapshoot based on what it knows. And Google's done very well to try and figure out what you want. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if you're running a website, you know, like a podcast about programming, if you are going to put ads, make sure they're ads about, you know, books to make you a better programmer, ergonomic keyboards. Make sure, you know, spend more time handpicking your advertiser, trying to get private ads, or trying to talk specifically to companies that you think you want to do ads with, or things like the Amazon Associates store, so that you can pick products that you know your constituents will like, and make sure it's not just a blind ad that they feel like a computer is programming and spitting them out for them. If they feel like you are working hard to give them things they want, then you have, I think, then a much higher chance of converting and having them, you know, if they're like, oh, well, Jade Robbins, you know, he really recommended this book and I trust his judgment, so I'll buy it too. Mm-hmm. It's not just, you know, like I always joke about this on Montana Fragfest. I talk about Team Fortress 2, and there's a character on there called the Heavy. One day I made a post about heavies, and the first Google AdSense ad that popped up was about heavy flow for a woman, and it just didn't fit. And, you know, eventually it figured it out. It got smarter, mm-hmm. but I don't, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just not good. I should get smarter about my advertising.
So at the bottom of this article, we've got a study that Smashing Magazine actually ran themselves. And the first little section is about typography. And they found that the good line height on average is 1.5. And that's actually what is recommended in most classical typography books.
Yep.
The next one is line length divided by line height is about 27.8. The average line length is 538 pixels. So, an optimal number of characters per line is about 55 to 75.
Yeah, make it short. It's easier for people to read.
The next section they did a little bit of a little study on blogs. The homepage, you know, shows about 10 to 20 posts. You don't want to have like 50 on there, yep, or like totally. Four.
Yep. The average sort of layout is, you know, for fixed layouts is between 951 to 1,000 pixels. That's about consistent. People like about 920, 960, a lot of the frameworks hit at these days.
Sign up links are usually in the top right corner.
Yeah, so for web forms, if you're doing a portfolio site, you know, 89% of the layouts are horizontally centered. Just good statistics. These aren't exactly rules, but these are just good things to know kind of what everyone else is doing.
This is interesting on web forms. Like, email confirmation is not given 82% of the time, but password confirmation is.
Interesting.
I don't know. Most web apps usually, well, I guess it's changing now because you usually have to activate at your email anyways.
Yeah.
So if you, I mean, it used to be, yeah, they verified you typed in your email address. They'll make you type it in twice.
Yeah.
But now.
Weird.
A little bit less.
I don't know. So check it out. This is a great article. The link will be in our show notes. There's a lot of resources at the end that you're going to want to check out and look at if you really want to dig into it. But just some useful items and nuggets for thoughts. That wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. I want to remind you guys that you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. You can leave feedback for the show by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. And again, we're trying this shorter time frame, a half an hour for an episode. Let us know what you think, if you like it or don't. We're really curious if you guys find it's easier to digest for a half an hour. let us know, or if you missed the longer sort of time frame, we want to hear from you. So thank you guys, and we will see you next week.